Hi, my name is Cecilia Pounin, and welcome to this episode of Brave New Women. All around the world, there are amazing, ordinary women doing extraordinary things. Brave New Women is about giving those women a platform and a voice, and it's about changing the way that women are perceived. And it's a way of inspiring all of us to do the things that we've always wanted to do. It's a great pleasure for me to be sitting down today with Rosalie Dillon Sinclair. When we were preparing this interview, Rosalie said to me, "Oh, you know, any mother would have done what I did." But I think when you hear her story, you'll agree with me that it's not any mother that would have done what Rosalie did. So Rosalie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Cecilia. Thanks for that lovely introduction. That was lovely.
It's a pleasure. Rosalie, when you had your first child, you discovered that after 8 weeks that she had cystic fibrosis.
And yes, that's right.
How did you feel at that moment?
It was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. Nothing can prepare you for that. We had no history of cystic fibrosis in our family history, and I traced it a long way back. Never really had any experiences of anybody close to us that had cystic fibrosis. So to have your eight-week-old baby diagnosed with that was absolutely devastating.
How did you know that something was wrong?
She was a baby that rarely slept. 45 minutes was the most time she would sleep in a day or night. So I would be lucky to get 4 45-minute periods of time in a 24-hour time frame that she would sleep. So she was screaming constantly. Her poos were very frothy and loose. She just seemed to be really unsettled, in pain. And I'd been to the doctor a couple of times because I was concerned, and it was sort of, they didn't really see anything wrong with her. She was putting on weight and everything looked normal, and they just sort of, one doctor even said, you know, you're just a nervous first-time mum, you're just a bit anxious, you need to
calm down.
And I was feeling like I was going insane, and people were saying to me, you know, you're eating, I was breastfeeding, and they're saying you're eating the wrong things, it's giving her wind. And so I just felt, it was down to the point where I think I was eating lettuce and hardly anything else, because everything I ate, people were saying, oh, that's made her upset, that's causing this upset to her digestion. And I just felt so overwhelmed. I couldn't work out what was wrong, and I felt like it was my fault. And I was at the doctor for, I think, a second or third time. I was actually on holidays away from my home. I'd gone to visit my parents in another city, and had been to the doctor there, a doctor I didn't know, who wasn't familiar with me, because she was so upset.
And your daughter was so upset.
Yes, my daughter was so upset. Yeah. You know, couldn't get her to settle. And it was Christmas, and I was staying with my parents, and she was still screaming, and no one was getting any sleep at night. So I thought, I'll go to the doctor, and I thought maybe she had lactose intolerance. So I went to the doctor there, and they were doing a test for that. So I had I put the test sample in, and I was going back to see what the results were. And the doctor called me in to his office and said, oh, you're the pediatrician that was at the hospital that delivered Ella in Brisbane. I was in Rockhampton. Wants to speak to you on the phone. And I thought, oh, that's unusual. And he then left the room and left me with the phone. And the pediatrician broke the news to me that from her heel prick test at birth, the results had come in that she had cystic fibrosis, and they'd been trying to locate me for a few weeks because I was on holidays. And so they finally found me through medical records and told me that she had cystic fibrosis. So I was just absolutely overwhelmed.
So you were sitting, you were severely lacking in sleep, eating lettuce, sitting by yourself in this room, and then they announced to you that your daughter has cystic fibrosis.
Yes.
Wow.
So Yeah, it was, my whole world crumbled. I don't know how I got out of the doctor's surgery, but somehow I managed to walk out of there. And my husband was in the waiting room, thankfully. And we drove back to my parents' house, and then we all sort of had to come to terms with the fact that this baby had a very serious disease that was going to impact on her life for the rest of her life. So it was, I think we all went, well, I particularly went through what you would call a grieving process, I think, where all of a sudden this baby that you think you've had and you've imagined it to be a certain way and you imagine its future, and all of a sudden that is changed in one phone call. Now you can't sort of see that future for that child, and you see a totally different future, one that's frightening. And so, it was a real grieving process, and not knowing where to turn, what life would be like for her, trying to educate myself about what the disease involved, which was absolutely frightening when you started to read the statistics and all the things that she would go through. It was just absolutely overwhelming.
So there were lots of tears, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, it was, And I think even to the point where you don't cry, I think, for a while, you're just in so much shock initially that I think the tears come later. You sort of go through shock, and then you go through sadness and fear, and even anger at times. So, yeah, it's a whole process of emotions that you've got to work through.
Did you have any support working through that, through those emotions?
No, I could have. I think I could have reached, you know, obviously I could have reached out and got some, but I think at the time I was just so overwhelmed. And like you said, I hadn't slept. It was 8 weeks of really hardly sleeping at all, and I don't think I was really in any frame of mind to know what kind of state I was in emotionally to seek that sort of help. My family was fantastic. I've got a really close family, and I think it was probably fortunate that I was at their place with my mum and dad and all my sisters around Christmas time, that everybody was there to support me. I think that was really important. That was crucial, I think, to coping with that diagnosis initially.
Mm-hmm. Just even hearing you talk about it is making me feel, you know, very emotional. Just imagining what you went through, and also feeling the warmth of your family and how they were supporting you. I mean, I can just hear that what you're saying. It's wonderful.
Yeah, they were terrific. Yeah, I can only imagine, you know, what it's like to hear a diagnosis for your child if you are, you know, a single parent, or you don't have those support systems. I just don't know how people would come through that, you know, and then having to take the initiative to reach out to a body or an organisation or something to try and get that sort of support and help. It must be really, really hard.
Mm. And you said, you said you did a lot of research on cystic fibrosis.
Yes.
So what actually is it? How does it manifest itself?
Yep, it's a genetic disease, and one in every 25 people carries the gene, and there's many different mutations. So the mutation that Ella has is Delta F508, which is the most common form of cystic fibrosis mutation, and it's the most severe. So there's a whole lot of them, and some of them aren't as severe as others. You might only be impacted by the disease slightly. And every person is different. You can have the worst genetic mutation and not be as sick as somebody who has a lesser form of mutation. So it's just such an unpredictable disease that doesn't run any, you know, straight course. It's variable in everybody. It affects mostly the lungs. So the lungs are what most people, their lungs are severely impacted. The mucus in the lungs becomes really thick, and therefore any bacteria can grow in there really easily. So you get lots of lung infections, which have to be cleared with intensive treatments. But over time, the damage to the lungs is what usually eventually kills people with cystic fibrosis. They either require lung transplants or even with lung transplants, sometimes, you know, the outcome is not good. So life expectancy is about 40. And over time, people with cystic fibrosis also develop lots of other issues because the disease affects most of the systems in the body. So any system in the body that needs fluid or flow of any kind of mucus to operate is going to be impacted. So people have liver issues, they develop osteoporosis, digestion is severely impacted. People with cystic fibrosis often have digestive issues and they need medication to digest their food because the secretions from the pancreas can't flow into the digestive system to digest the food. So, it's such a multitude of issues that people with CF are dealing with, and it impacts, like I said, nearly every system in the body.
Gosh, it sounds like you've become an absolute expert on it.
Well, I started reading when she was diagnosed. The hospital in Brisbane, the Children's Hospital, contacted me straight away, and the professor there spoke to me and sort of introduced me to what, you know, life with someone with CF might be like. And she was really encouraging and really positive. Like, she said that not every person with CF develops every aspect of it, and, you know, people can go on to lead normal, happy, productive lives and deal with the disease as they go. And she sort of recommended some, sent me a pack of information and recommended some places to look to educate myself about it. And I just found it so overwhelming initially. I started to read about it, and I think I came to the point where I just stopped reading. I couldn't sort of go down the path of lung transplants and osteoporosis and liver transplants when you're sort of nursing an 8-week-old baby. You just can't sort of put your head into that space all in one go. So I had to sort of filter the information sort of as needed so that I could actually cope with what I was finding out at the time. So, yeah, it was a lot of reading, but I had to really be careful how much I got into the education side of it because it was just overwhelming.
And so what happened? She was 8 weeks old. You get the diagnosis. And what happened after that?
We had to go to the hospital and get medication. So people with CF take digestive enzymes to help them digest their food. So once we got those enzymes and got those into her, she was such a changed baby. It was almost immediate. The enzymes enabled her to digest the breast milk that I was feeding her, and she actually slept for normal periods of time. She started to put on weight. Her poos were more normal. It was incredible, just that one medication.
So she was actually starving, was she?
She was hungry, always hungry.
Wow.
And whatever you put into her stomach, she couldn't digest. So it would become painful and gassy. And so she was hungry combined with in pain, tired. So it was just, she was just absolutely raw, you know, overall.
Oh, poor little thing.
It was terrible. I used to look down at her, and she'd be screaming up at me, and I'd be thinking, you know, what is wrong? You look like you're in pain. And she'd look, her eyes would make eye contact, and she'd just be screaming as if to say, help me. And I just did not know what to do. It was terrible. Mm. So getting the medication was a life changer for her. It was just such a relief. It was incredible. And then we had to go down to Brisbane to the hospital there with her and learn how to do physiotherapy on her. So it was percussion on her chest, and that was at least once a day, sometimes twice a day, which is really a lot of my friends and family would watch me doing this on like a 9, 10-week-old baby, and some of them found it very challenging to stay in the room and watch because, you know, you're sort of tapping or pounding on this little tiny baby's chest to make sure that you loosen all the mucus and they can clear it out of their lungs. And it can be, it looks sort of looks a bit, I guess, a bit rough. So, yeah, that had to be done at least once, twice a day on a baby that sometimes didn't really want to have that done. Mm-hmm. But that was important to keep her chest and her lungs clear. So
what are you doing? Are you tapping with your fingertips or with your...
Yeah, they actually gave us a little, the little masks that they would use on babies, say, to put them under anaesthetic. It just goes over the little nose and mouth. They would use that like a little rubber cup and you would have to tap that all over her chest and her back. Quite briskly so that you are loosening up the mucus in the chest. So, yeah.
That makes her cough, does it? Does she then cough it up? Then that
can be coughed up if it loosens it up enough to irritate her throat and airway, she'll cough it up and that will clear it out. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was the goal. And they do that on the babies because that's really the only thing you can do at that age to clear the chest, but as they get older, about two, they encourage them to do what we call PEP, where they actually use breathing exercises, resistance breathing into a mask, lots of breathing into that so that you're forcing the lungs to open up, and that's much more productive. So that's sort of a more active approach to it, where the child is actually physically exercising their lungs rather than just relying on tapping and loosening the mucus. So they breathe into a resistance mask and it's 10 sets of 10, so it's 100 breaths. And in between each set of 10, they do a series of huffs and coughs so that anything that they've loosened up, they cough up. And that's the best way to sort of keep their chest clear and prevent them from getting lots of what they call exacerbations, where they get infections in the chest.
Mm-hmm. And so before you had Ella, you were a school teacher.
Yes.
Was there any way you could have gone back and taught after she was born?
I had planned to go back. I had planned. I remember saying to all my friends, I'll be back. They'd say, you're going. And I'd say, I'll be back. Don't worry, I'll be back. But I found it impossible to go back because it was really a full-time job. It was physiotherapy twice a day, medication with every meal, and also I really worried about exposing her to, like, putting her into daycare would mean she'd obviously be in a situation where she'd pick up lots of colds and childhood illnesses and that sort of thing, and that is a risk for people with CF too. Every time you get a cold or a flu or even just a childhood disease like chickenpox or anything like that, for a person with CF, that can be quite serious. A cold can turn into a serious chest infection. You can end up in hospital for a couple of weeks on IV medications to try and clear that infection out of the chest. So for me, going back to teaching was just, I found it just not a choice really. And I was quite happy to stay home. That was my goal, was to make sure that she was, looked after to the best of my ability. So, yeah, I didn't go back to work.
Mm. And so you just let's fast forward a few years. I understand that you then decided to have another child. So tell me about that.
Yes, it took a long time to decide to have another child because the decisions involved are so complicated. I had to decide whether, if I had another child, would it have cystic fibrosis and how would I deal with that? Would I be able to deal with that? And for me, that was, I just could not choose to have another child with CF. It was, for me, it would be overwhelming and not something I would choose. So I decided to wait a while I processed all those sorts of thoughts. And eventually I came to the conclusion that I would like to have another child. And so I conceived naturally with the assumption that I would have screening done at about 10, 11 weeks pregnant to test for CF and make a decision on whether I continued with the pregnancy. And even that in itself is such a difficult thing to decide on or think about or even talk about to anybody, because I think it's such a contentious issue for lots of people, deciding whether to terminate a pregnancy or not. So I had to work through all those decisions. And I did conceive naturally, and then it was an ectopic pregnancy. So I ended up one Saturday night in emergency, having emergency surgery to remove that pregnancy because it was obviously growing in the wrong place. So,
oh, my gosh.
And by this stage, I was 38 and I had Ella and emotional strength to make choices about having a second child. So I was about 42 when I had my ectopic pregnancy, and then I wanted to try and get pregnant again. And I remember the gynecologist, it wasn't happening easily after that because one tube was blocked where they'd done the emergency surgery. And I remember the gynecologist telling me one day to just go home and forget about having a child. I needed to put that aside and get on with my life and pretty much give up on that idea. And I felt really dismissed. I felt really upset by her lack of support or what she told me and what she thought was my future. So that devastated me for a little bit. And then I changed doctors. I went back to the doctor that in Brisbane that I had had Ella through, and she was an older mother herself. She'd had children later in life, and I said, you know, what can I do? I'm not getting pregnant. I want to have another baby. I've been told it's hopeless. And she was really supportive. She said, look, we can try IVF. And she said the benefit of that is you can screen your embryos before they're transferred back into your uterus for the disease, and that can eliminate that need to terminate a pregnancy. And you've got a better chance of falling pregnant this way anyway. And I thought, oh, that's fantastic. So I decided to do that. So I did one round of IVF and it wasn't successful. I had lots of eggs, but because of my age, they weren't eggs that would grow on to the stage you needed them to be at to test them. And most of them sort of fizzled out and faded away before they were viable. So I did one round and that was no good. And then I did a second round, and I think I used to get something like 15 embryos, which was for my age was pretty amazing. And then by the day six where they needed to be tested, I had one embryo left. Mm. And I remember the phone call. The doctor talked to me about, you know, we can test this embryo. It's of the stage now. It's healthy. We can test it for cystic fibrosis, but the risk to that embryo, like if you've got three or four or five and you test them, you might lose one or two through the testing process. And if we test this one embryo, the chances are it may not survive the testing process, and at your age, given that this is the only embryo you've had out of two rounds, this could be your last chance. So you need to decide whether you want to test it and possibly lose it, or transfer it, have a pregnancy, and then do the testing when you're about 10 weeks pregnant and decide if it's got cystic fibrosis or not, whether you want to terminate or keep going with the pregnancy. So this created a whole other dilemma for me. But I decided to go ahead and transfer the embryo without having it tested. And then I had to wait 10 weeks and have testing with the needle through the stomach. And then they rang me one day and said, we've got your test results back. And I said, okay. And they said, would you like to know if it's a male or female embryo? And I said, no, because I didn't want to think about it as a little girl or a little boy. I said, I don't want to know anything until I know, you know, if it's got cystic fibrosis or not. And they said, no, it's all clear, totally clear, and it's a little girl. I just burst into tears. I was just crying. It was an amazing thing, and it was so rare because people with CF, like my husband carries the gene and I carry the gene, so having children, even two people with CF carrying that gene, you've got a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with cystic fibrosis. And then you've got a 1 in 4 chance of having a child that doesn't have cystic fibrosis and also doesn't even carry the gene. So Lily didn't inherit any of the genetic material. So she's totally cystic fibrosis free. So there's no chance that she could ever have children who will have CF either. So it was the best possible outcome, I guess, in terms of her health. Yeah.
What decisions you've had to make, and what worry and waiting and then the relief of hearing that actually she was fine. I mean, that's
clear.
Yes. Wow, the emotional roller coaster.
It was, you know, so up and down, but it's amazing. You know, there was another child there waiting for me, or that, you know, if I took chances and was brave enough and strong enough, that would happen in one way or another. So, you know, I guess when you're faced with challenges, sometimes you just have to know that you've got the strength to weigh it all up and get through it and make sure you know what you can handle and what you can't handle. I think that was the thing for me, knowing, could I terminate a pregnancy? How would I react to that? Is it the right thing to do? And even questions like for Ella, if she asked me in the future if I had terminated a child with CF, I had to think to myself, well, how would she feel if she said to me, well, you terminated a baby that had CF and I've got CF? So all those sorts of psychological issues, I really, really had to think everything through and know that I had come up with the right answers for me and for her before I sort of made any of these decisions and went through with everything.
What was your decision-making process? Would you just go into your thoughts and think through it by yourself? Or were you talking to your husband about it? Were you talking to friends? Were you talking to your parents? What was your process in that?
Yeah, a lot of it I would always work through it myself first. I would go through all the possibilities. How would I feel if I never had another child? How would I feel if I got pregnant and I had another child with CF? So I'd go through for myself, I'd work out what I was comfortable with, what I knew I could handle, what I couldn't handle, and I would think through the outcomes for myself. But I also spoke to my husband. We would talk a lot about choices, and I'd cry to him and say, you know, I don't know if I can do this or that. And he was always really supportive, really positive, you know, supportive, and pretty much whatever I felt I needed to do, he was on board with, which was amazing. And he was always positive when I would be crying, saying, oh, I don't think, you know, is it the right thing to do? He would say, if you want to do it, let's do it. So that was really comforting. And my family too, I would talk to them about what I was going to do, and they were great. Even if I'm sure they had opinions that maybe were different to mine about my choices, but never once did anyone close to me ever sort of say, well, terminating a pregnancy, that's terrible. You know, we're pro-life, you can't do that. Or they listened, they had their own opinions, but they were always supportive. And my best friend Lou Walsh, I talked to her endlessly about my choices, and once again she was really supportive, just was there for me, listened, encouraged. I think that's the other thing you need when you're going through something like this, is for people to be encouraging for you and supporting you. I think that's critical to be able to make the right decisions for yourself.
I think that's a great message too for people who are in a support role, who are around people who are dealing with difficult issues, that what they need is encouragement and support and listening and, you know, all those things that are just so important.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it definitely helps. That's for sure.
So let's just, you had Lily, and then where was Ella up to at that stage when?
She had just started PrEP, which was a huge, a huge event for her. So she started.
So prep is the first year of school?
Yes. So she was 5 and she started prep. And I had Lily towards the end of her first year at prep. And that was a challenge because I'd kept Ella at home pretty much isolated with me right up, 5 years basically. We didn't go out in winter. We avoided, anyone who was sick wasn't welcome at my house. Everyone knew that because I was trying to, if people with CF, kids with CF contract Pseudomonas, which is one of the particularly bad bacteria that infect the chests of people with cystic fibrosis or the lungs, if they contract that before, I read somewhere where if they contract that before they're 5, it can severely, particularly girls for some reason, it can severely shorten their life expectancy. So my goal was to keep her as well as possible for as long as possible, and where I felt she didn't need to, be doing things in the community or I didn't need to put her in daycare, I could look after her at home. I avoided those situations as much as possible so that she didn't get as many colds and things as most other kids. And that kept her in good stead. So, but the disadvantage of that was socially, she was behind the eight ball. She'd only had the little boy next door to play with most of the time because I could always know, I could say to his mum, is he sick? Is he well? And if he's well, they can play together. He's got a runny nose. No, they can't. So I could control that part of her environment. So she, when she went to prep, she had not much clue about socializing, interacting with other kids. It was all a whole new world to her. And it was, it was a difficult year, a really difficult year for her. Even things like the first time they said, come and sit on the carpet. We're going to read a story. Everyone sit on the mat. And all the kids just went over and sat down and she sort of watched them go and didn't really know what this was all about and just sort of stood back. And I watched it and thought, wow, she's missed out on a lot of social interaction and normal expectations of kids her age. So that was a really difficult year trying to educate the teachers on the medications she needed and the time frame they had to be taken in. They had to be taken within 15 minutes of her eating for them to be effective, and trying to make sure they understood if anyone was sick, if they could make sure Ella wasn't seated next to them, and all that sort of thing. So it was very challenging. And then Lily came along towards the end of that year, but it worked out really well. But prep was a difficult year. And then in grade one, Ella had a teacher called Mrs. L, who was absolutely amazing, and she turned Ella's whole world around, because up to that point Ella wasn't really fitting in, she was struggling. This teacher, and I spoke to this teacher at the beginning of the year and mentioned all these things, that she's got CF, this is what we need to do, and I said, last year reports where she wasn't getting on very well with kids, she's this and she's that, and she was just such an amazing positive teacher. She just said, oh, okay, great. Well, I'm sure we'll have a good year. And she just embraced Ella like you would not believe. I can remember after the first term going in to see her and saying, how is she going? Is everything working out? And she made the point of saying to me, she pointed out how many friends Ella had and what a good friend she was to people. I'm getting teary now because it was such a lovely thing to say. She just focused on all the positive things and just absolutely turned Ella's world around. I think it was just that acknowledgement of the challenges and helping Ella meet them. It just made a lot of difference. It was incredible.
And so then she finished year one, and then how was her schooling after that?
Well, she was fortunate to have Mrs. L for 2 years in a row, and she, as I said, she was a changed child. She was, she had friends. She's really bright. So school from then on, in terms of getting on with people, socialising, academically achieving, was wonderful. She had some hospitalisations. Grade one was the first time that she had to be admitted to hospital to treat a lung infection. So she actually contracted Pseudomonas in grade one, which is the one that lots of parents with CF dread, because it's one that has to be treated intravenously in hospital. So they admit the kids into the hospital and they have to insert a tube, usually through their arm, right up into a blood vessel near the heart, so they can pump the antibiotics directly into that vessel. And so that was the first time. That was pretty overwhelming and frightening. You're in there for 2 weeks and it's constantly, it took 2 to 3 hours under anaesthetic to insert that tube, because their veins are so tiny and it's so difficult to get it right into the vessels they need to get it into, that it can take a long time. They use, I think, ultrasounds and things to guide it. So it was about 2 or 3 hours under anaesthetic, and it was frightening having to take your 7-year-old child into an operating theatre to walk her in and put her on the slab, so to speak, and watch as they put a mask on her face and put her under, and she's looking at you and you're sort of saying, you'll be okay. So that was really hard.
And you're going, my God, I hope she's okay. My God, I hope she's okay.
Exactly. Oh. Yep. And you're trying to reassure her, but really you're thinking to yourself, there's so much that can go wrong here.
Mm.
And then, leaving the room and waiting 2 or 3 hours to hear that it's all been done. So that was her first admission. And they, like I said, they pump antibiotics nonstop for 2 weeks into that intensive physiotherapy. They have physiotherapists that come to her room twice a day and do lots of exercise and getting her to huff and cough and clear her chest, dietitians working with her to make sure her nutrition's right and she's putting on weight. So, every time a child or someone with CF gets what they call an exacerbation or a lung infection that they are worried they can't clear with oral antibiotics, that's where they end up in hospital for 2 weeks. So, Ella was fortunate. She went to hospital once in grade one, and then I think she went again in grade two and twice in grade four. But some kids and some people with CF are in hospital 6 times a year. They might end up there trying to clear chest infections, lung infections. And for some of them, it's just an endless in and out of hospital. So schooling, normal life just takes a backseat to trying to get your lungs back in order. So she has been really fortunate. And I think the things that help with that are, and I decided this right from the beginning, that whatever they told us we had to do, we would do to make sure that she had the best chance. So the right diet, taking the meds the right way, the physiotherapy is essential. They told us early on, you must do it every day, at least once a day when she's well, and twice a day if she's got a cold or a cough. So that was, I think, the critical thing. If you can do that, it gives the person with CF a much better chance of having a normal life. But you've just got to be prepared to, I guess, give up a lot of your time in the day to do those things, because physio can take, for her now, up to an hour a day. So if she's got to do that twice a day, that's an hour in the morning before school and an hour at night before she goes to bed to make sure that she does those exercises and the PEP to clear her lungs. So I made that decision that we would make sure that, we followed instructions and all the protocols, and I think that has really kept her in good stead, and also making sure that they have a really active physical exercise program. Kids that are active and physically active with CF will often fare a lot better, because they're clearing their lungs regularly and keeping lung fitness. When Ella was 6, I also enrolled her in singing lessons, because I'd read that that would be really beneficial for the lungs, the breathing and that sort of thing. So she at 6 started singing lessons, and she has just, that was just such a godsend, because she's now a brilliant singer, dancer, actor. It's taken her to competitions overseas.
Just tell me about that. How did that happen that she went to the competitions overseas? Just focus on that a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. Well, she studied singing. She loved singing, and she loved Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift was her hero. So one day she said to me, "Mum, do you think I could meet Taylor Swift?" And she was in grade, I think grade 4 or 5, might have been grade 5.
So how old was she approximately?
She would have been, what would that be, about grade 10 or 11? Oh, sorry, age 10 or 11. So I think she was 11. No, she was 10. And, you know, your child asks you that and you sort of think, oh, great, that's an easy one to pull off. That should be no worries.
Sure.
I thought, oh, anytime. Great. Yeah. And then I started to think about it, and she loved singing. And she, in year 4, she'd been in hospital twice and she'd been quite ill. And the Pseudomonas, they put them in hospital to try and clear it from their lungs. And after the second hospitalisation in year 4, in year 5, we found out that the Pseudomonas is what they call colonized, which means there's no hope of clearing it from the lungs. It's there forever. And that's what they try to avoid as long as possible. Once it's colonized, it actually forms a mucoidal film over itself, and it won't be killed by the antibiotics. So all you can hope to do then is manage it, keep it at bay. So we found out in grade 5, I think it was, that it was colonized and that they could not clear it. So that meant, a different prognosis, I guess. You've got to really be on top of things, and there's a chance that it can flare up and you can't, it won't respond to treatments. So that was a little bit overwhelming and a bit hard to sort of swallow at that point. And she was, I think the fact that we'd found this out and she was worried and it was not a good thing to hear. When she said, oh, do you think I could meet Taylor Swift? And she was so keen on singing, so in love with singing, I thought, what can I do? And her singing teacher, an amazing woman, Alison Goodwin, she just embraced Ella also and was just like a mentor to her, always, you know, never accepted anything less than she's going to go on and be brilliant, and another woman who, you know, supported everything that Ella did. She was really encouraging. And then I thought, if I contacted Cystic Fibrosis Queensland, who are an amazing support group for people with CF in Queensland, I thought I'll contact them and they might know Make-A-Wish Foundation or someone who might be able to know how I could get in contact with someone who could help me with this. So I contacted them and they jumped on board straight away. They were amazing. They started a Facebook campaign, a social media campaign to try and get some sort of something out there in the community to see if we could meet Taylor Swift, because Taylor Swift was coming to Australia for a tour, a concert tour. So they started this media campaign. And then a lady at a radio station in Brisbane, Lizzie, she was a producer for one of the radio shows there. She heard about it and she jumped on board, and she had connections to much bigger media outlets and avenues, and she started making it her special project. And she was an amazing lady as well. She herself had just recovered from, she'd been on death's door, and she'd just recovered from that. They told her she wasn't going to make it, and she pulled through, and she helped us with that. She took it on board and just became this amazing campaigner for Ella's wish to meet Taylor Swift. So the media campaign went on and on, and the concert was getting closer and closer. And Lizzie eventually made contact with Taylor Swift's PR people, and she left her phone number with them, and they were going to get back to her. The concert came, and we had tickets to the concert here in Brisbane, and we went and saw it, and we didn't hear from the Taylor Swift camp. So we thought, well, it just couldn't happen. It obviously, you know, wasn't something that was going to happen. And then I think it was a couple of days after the concert, Lizzie found out that she'd given them her mobile phone number, which started with a 04. And when you ring a mobile from overseas, apparently from America, you don't use the zero. And they'd been putting the zero in front and not being able to get through to her to tell her Taylor Swift wants to meet Ella. So once she found that out, she was devastated, and she contacted them again and said, oh, you know, look, this is what's happened. And they said, well, Taylor Swift's still in Australia. She's doing a concert in Adelaide in the next couple of days. Let's fly Ella to Adelaide and she can meet her there. So that's what they did. They Cystic Fibrosis Queensland helped us. Lizzie helped us. And we flew to Adelaide and Ella got to meet Taylor Swift before the concert, which was, she was just a beautiful person. She was so kind, took her time, spoke beautifully. She was absolutely lovely. And I think that for Ella was the turning point in terms of, up till that point, it had all been about this disease she has and, you know, the negatives of it. But I think that gave her some kind of hope that good things can happen in life and that there is positive things that you can achieve, and that her singing was something that could probably see her through that. So her singing teacher, Alison Goodwin, then decided that she should enter a competition in Los Angeles, the World Championships of Performing Arts, and it occurs in Los Angeles every year. And so many people are chosen to represent Australia in singing, dancing, acting. So Ella auditioned for that and she was selected to go over there. And we decided that we would support her in that because it was, you know, it was, you've got to chase your dreams and do what you can in life. So she went over to Los Angeles and competed, and she won several medals. She got to the semi-finals, I think, in singing. I think it was acting, dancing, and singing too. I think there were so many sections she was in. She didn't make it to the finals, but while we were there, the people from the New York Film Academy have judges and scouts in the audience, and they offered her a partial scholarship to the New York Film Academy for a summer school in acting. Wow. So from that wonderful experience, which just created so much confidence and positivity and belief in her, from that competition, which was life-changing for her, she got this other opportunity to go to New York and do a month acting school with the New York Film Academy. So between the Los Angeles competition and the New York Film Academy, Lizzie also decided that it would be great for Ella to meet Delta Goodrum, who was performing in Cats, the musical, in Brisbane. And she, through her connections, arranged for Ella, because Ella loved her as well, she arranged for her to meet her after the Cats performance. And once again, another really special lady who took the time after her performance to meet with Ella and was just so inspiring. She was amazing. And so
do you remember what they spoke about?
No, I can't. I was off to the side, but they seemed to, I don't know what they spoke about, to be honest. I think it was about singing and how long she'd been singing, and Ella talked about how good Delta was in Cats. And yeah, and she was just very interested in Ella and what she was doing, you know, asked her questions about what she was doing and her singing and all that sort of thing. So yeah, but really humble, down to earth. You would swear that it was just, you know, your next door neighbour you were sitting there talking to. She took that time to be like that, which was amazing. So after that experience, we decided, yep, that we'd make the New York Film Academy work. So the following year, we took her over there for a month and she went to school there. And once again, all these experiences were just incredible. And so positive and so life-inspiring for her. It's made a huge difference to her life. And probably those things have only happened because of the cystic fibrosis, because of the opportunities that people have provided for her knowing that she has this disease and trying to help her and support her. So it's been incredible.
Mm. So where is she up to now? How old is she now? And what are her plans? What's she doing?
Yeah, she's 16 now. So that was 3 years ago that we went to New York. And at the moment she's focused heavily on school. She's a bright girl, so she does really well academically. So she got ducks of year 10 last year, and her last report card was A pluses for every subject, and she's not sure she wanted to do something maybe in medicine. She's talking about law. So she's got really big goals for herself. She works really hard and she wants to do something like that. But also she's playing that up against the singing and performing side of it. So she constantly trains with her singing teacher and dance teacher. And so she's always got that as sort of a, I don't know, it works in with the academic achievement. So I don't know which way she'll go.
I've got a friend who you may know because she's actually on television a lot in Australia called Cindy Pan. And
oh, yes.
Yeah, I went to school with her. She's one of my close friends. And she was a dancer and she was also ducks about school. Yeah. And she did medicine and also combined that with writing books, with writing for the newspaper, with being on television, with dancing, with acting, with, you know, with just all sorts of things. So it might be good for Ella to meet her at some stage.
Oh, that would be great. I remember Cindy. She was on a lot of TV shows as a doctor. I can remember listening to her talking. Yes. Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that about her. Yeah, yeah. That's great. Yeah. And that's encouraging that, you know, people can balance the two and embrace all of their options. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's great.
I wanted to ask you also, how has it been having two children? Because you've got Ella who's needed so much support. And how have you managed to manage that with Lily? Because I know that sometimes when you've got children who need a lot of attention, the other children get left out. So how's it been, you know, being the mother of two children?
Yeah, that's a huge thing because, managing cystic fibrosis does take a lot of time and a lot of energy. And I think I was lucky in one way that I had Ella at home with me until she had to go to prep. So she was five and it was just her and I, you know, my constant attention, full-time attention. And then she went to prep and Lily came along. So I had Lily at home with me while Ella was at school so I could put all my time and attention into her while she was home with me, and then Ella would come home and then the focus would, I guess, switch to what needed to be done with her. So that was an advantage in a lot of ways that Lily did have that one-on-one time a lot with me while Ella was at school. I don't know what it would have been like if they'd been born closer together and I had Ella at home all day while I was managing Lily. I think that would have been really difficult. I think Lily probably would have missed out a fair bit. And even now I know there's jealousies between them. I think sometimes the distance between them, the six years, creates, they're at different ages, they want different things. So it can be really hard. I find they are very jealous of each other and of my time with each of them. And I found my husband had to come on board. When I had Lily, he had to come on board a lot more with helping me manage things like Ella's physiotherapy, because when you're nursing a baby and you're trying to help a six-year-old do their physiotherapy, it was just so hard. So he would, before he went to work, he would do the physio, and when he'd come home from work, he'd do the physio. So that was a huge help. And my family, once again, when Lily was born, my mum moved in with us for a little while and helped with Lily. I have had lots of support. Lou, my friend Lou, I remember she would come down and help me out as well. So lots of support with that, with the two of them. But, yeah, it is a challenge sometimes to balance it out. And when I've had to take Ella to hospital and spend all day at the hospital with her, Lily would be at home with Pete or my mother And then that's challenging too, because you're out of their life and their day for a long time. So, yeah, that's been tricky balancing that, but it's so far it's worked, I think. Fingers crossed.
Rosalie, I mean, I think that's just an amazing story. I mean, I just want to acknowledge how much you yourself have put into your parenting of Ella, your parenting of Lily, how dedicated you've been in making sure that you followed all the protocols and giving her all the opportunities that you have in life. I don't think every mother would have done that. I think that what you've done is amazing. And before we finish, I just wanted to ask you, do you have a particular message that you'd like to give to the people who are listening?
Yeah, thanks, Cecilia. That's really lovely of you to say that. I really appreciate that. I do have a message. I think that when something like this happens to a child or to someone in your life or to you, I think it changes you in lots of ways. And I think the thing that I've learned from this whole experience in life with Ella has been compassion for other people's struggles, what people are going through. You don't realize until something like this happens to you and you go to a hospital where there's hundreds of other parents dealing with something like this or worse than this every day, talking to people, you realize the struggles that everyone's going through. So that has changed me in that now I look past the superficial and hopefully see the struggle and have compassion for people. And as a teacher, I was a teacher and I thought I was doing a great job. But I think if I went back to teaching now, I would be a totally different kind of teacher. Before I would go in and I would have my agenda and what I wanted to get done for the day and what I was going to teach the kids. And now I think I'd go in and my primary role would be, I think, to support each child in what they needed at that time on that day, rather than, you know, going in and thinking I had all the answers and I was going to change the world. I think compassion for people is the main message here, just understanding and compassion.
Oh, what a fabulous message. It's just been, for me, sitting here listening to you has been a joy for me. It's been, you've given me, it's like you've given me my Christmases all at once.
Oh, just fantastic. Oh, thanks, Cecilia. That's really amazing. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. Yeah.
And I'll make sure that Ella gets in contact with Cindy. And I really look forward to hearing.
Fabulous.
I really look forward to hearing how she develops and what decisions she makes and seeing how she develops in for the rest of her life. So thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Cecilia. Thanks again.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Brave New Women. On Friday, 22 January, I'll be holding a free webinar to talk about how women can stand up and speak up. There'll be two sessions, 8:30 a.m. in Paris, which is 6:30 p.m. in Sydney, and then the second session at 2:30 p.m. Paris, which is 8:30 a.m. on the US East Coast. If you'd like to join us, please connect on LinkedIn or on the Brave New Women Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening.